ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Corbin Middlemass from ABC Sport, here with the voice of summer, Jim Maxwell, as we count down Jim's top six moments in Ashes history that he has lived through, many of them as a commentator, but this one, Jim, involving a mutton-chopped West Australian at Lords back in 1972, predated your commentary and your media career. Take us back to Lords in 72.
Yes, it's amazing to think back to July 1972. I just happened to be at Lords because I was a member of the Australian Old Collegians World Tour team that went, you know, from Sydney through Hawaii, America, Bermuda, played for a month in London, a month touring. It was about 3.5 months. We played 90 games, but we just happened to be at Lords when the test match was on. In fact, for the whole tour, we were made honorary members of Lords and we sat in the pavilion. So that was quite a privilege. And then to be there at that extraordinary game where Massey took all those wickets from nowhere after we'd been beaten at Manchester in the first test match. So the most extraordinary thing that hits my brain when I think about it was the conditions at Lords. It was overcast every day. So you could argue, if you're one of the true believers, that swing bowling comes about when the atmosphere is heavy, that makes the ball move around. Well, it was ideal for someone like Massey. And they'd not seen much of Massey at all. He barely played for Australia. He played in the game at the MCG against the rest of the world when a bloke called Sober smashed them all over the ground. He turned up in England with his reputation as a great swing bowler. But it was on this occasion that everything just clicked for him. He did have a fellow called Dennis Lilly at the other end. And England won the toss and batted. And they made what seemed to be an okay 284. And somehow along the way, Massey picked up wickets. Nothing out of the ordinary, but he did get six.
Gifford could hardly be expected to face Massey for long, nor did he. After playing for little more than half an hour, the score was 272 for 9.
Australia, I can still remember the Australian batting. They got a skinny lead. But the person who was at the end of that innings, I would have thought, potentially man of the match, if they had such a thing in those days, was one G.S. Chappell. He made 131, some of the sweetest on-driving you've ever seen.
Fine stroke from Greg Chappell. Mike Smith is the fieldsman, just 2 runs.
You'll remember that lovely way he stood tall and waited for the ball to get underneath his nose and tip it through the onside, many other places as well. But it was a gorgeous innings to watch and to put Australia in a good position, which very quickly became an embarrassing one for England when they were, I think, at the end of the third, fourth day, 9 for 86 at stumps.
Smith was the only England batsman who produced an innings worth calling an innings, but he couldn't be expected to carry the side on his own. Soon enough, he too fell to Massey.
Extraordinary in the first innings to have got 6 wickets, but in the second innings, when they needed to make sure they didn't have the score to chase, he bowled around the wicket to people like Edrich and still swinging the ball late away. And most of the English batsmen hadn't quite worked out from his hand what was going on. So they were playing late and he was swinging it late. So there were a lot of people caught behind the wicket on that around the wicket angle. It was an extraordinary bit of bowling. And it, again, as I mentioned, was helped by Lilly getting Boycott, as I recall, to play the ball onto his stumps somewhere along the line. But just the most extraordinary bowling performance. We've all seen wonderful bowling performances, but over 2 innings, 16 wickets, unbelievable. And it just made the series, of course.
Yeah, it's an incredible scorecard where even you read it now and you go, there's 8 wickets for Massey, 2 for Lilly. Second inning, same thing again, 2 for Lilly, 8 for Massey as the two guys that were able to get it done for Australia on that occasion. So Bob Massey, a little bit about him. So he's a swing bowler out of Perth. As I said, he had the iconic sort of mutton chops back in the day that he was rolling with. He was 25 years of age when he burst onto the scene. So the backstory goes that he actually tried out for Northamptonshire in the lead up. It went to, I think, a couple of training sessions, and basically they gave him the flick and said, no, not for us. Mm. All of a sudden he rolls up, puts a bag of green on his head, and turns out what was at the time the best ever figures by a player on debut.
All out, with 8 of England's wickets falling to Massey for 84 runs in the first innings of his Test debut.
Yes, well, I got to know Bob in years thereafter because he was an expert commentator on the ABC in Perth for quite a long time. And in fact, he asked me after a few years of me going to Perth for Test matches, come and stay here, you don't want to stay in a hotel, and I did. But the interesting connection for me initially was that there I am at Lord's, July 1972. Within 10 months, I was working for the ABC. I had no idea at the time.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons was the last audition I did at the top of the Noble Stand was when Pakistan played Australia, I think it was February the next year, 73. And he was batting, not bowling as it turned out, with a fellow called Johnny Watkins, only Test. And they added 88 for the 8th wicket, which was enough to give Australia something to bowl at because they were well behind in the game against Pakistan. And most of the shots played by those two batsmen, who could bat a bit, yep. Watkins particularly, was the attempted square off drive that went wide with third slip, fourth slip. There were a lot of thick edges. So the ball was doing a bit. So goodness knows how they got the runs, but they did, as well, often happens against Pakistan, I suppose. And that turned the game over, and Lilly bowled unchanged at one end while Max Walker took 6 for 15, and they bowled him out for 103. So it was a huge win for Australia. And that was just before they went to the West Indies. They didn't have Ashley Mallett. They took 3 leg spinners, including Watkins. But Bob Massey's career basically ended in that series because on the dry Caribbean pitches, he couldn't get the ball to swing. There was no such thing as reverse, whatever. So it's a bit like the golfer getting the yips, I think. He never really got his mojo back as a swing bowler. So it was one of those meteoric careers that didn't resume. Yeah. And yes, I say, working with him in Perth, and seeing those two balls that were there—they were on the mantelpiece in his house in Perth for a long, long time.
Yeah.
They're in the museum at Lord's now. He gifted, sold them to Lord's, whatever it was. But yes, they're often picked up and tossed around and chatted about because of that extraordinary performance, which in itself was extraordinary. But when you look at overall, I think about 25 test wickets in his career, 16 of them in one game. So all quite remarkable. So it's a lovely a little bit of, what will I call it, a personal history and a cricket history that's connected to R.A.L. Massey.
Amazing. So as you said, I played only 5 more tests, never even took forfeit again in any one particular innings, dropped from the WA team 18 months later. And interestingly, he did return to the West Australian team thereafter, but 2.5 years after that episode at Lord's, that was his last first-class game. So he was only 25 when he debuted, and basically he'd finished playing first-class cricket by the time he was in his late 20s, and as you said, went on to work for the ABC for a decade, so obviously was still in and around the game for many years after that, despite the fact his playing career.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Yes.
Lovely to talk to you.
Yes, absolutely. And I was lucky enough to do a little bit of work with him as well at community radio after he'd finished with the ABC, and he's a lovely man, a gentleman, Bob Massey. A couple of things to pick up on what you said there. So when you were sitting at Lord's watching the cricket in July of 72, you never thought, I'm going to spend the next 50 years as a radio commentator. How do you go from sitting there in the outer to all of a sudden end up in 10 months knocking out a demo tape?
Well, it'd been a little bit of planning because I'd had 2 goes at getting in as what was then a sports trainee at the ABC. So I didn't know until I got home, and my mother had kept a cutting from the paper. And that was in September of that year, that there was another one coming up. And so without going through the whole of it, that's what happened. And part of that in January 73, before I did this audition, I went to New Zealand with my old Cranbrookians cricket club, and Peter Mears, who'd got the first job I applied for in 1967 at the ABC, was there. Peter himself was a very good cricketer, played first grade, fast medium bowler, good athlete, and he gave me a few hints about what I should do in this audition, because he got a few ideas from watching, talking to Alan McGilvray. So that was all part of the process, which led to this extraordinary redirection. On April the 6th, 1973, when I started in the ABC.
Just looking through the record, the scorecard, and obviously this was a little bit before I came along, Jim, but I was, as I said, lucky enough to work with Bob and heard a lot about this particular fixture. You mentioned Greg Chappell's innings in particular. So this was the second 100 that he'd scored for of the 24 test hundreds, but it didn't, I mean, if you read all the reports, and as you sort of alluded to, it feels like that was the breakout 100 though, wasn't it? The one that really announced himself as a genuine world-class test batsman, and he was going to be a guy that was going to be there for a long time to come.
Well, he and his brother are under pressure a lot in that series.
It took the Chappell brothers to settle Australia down, with Captain Ian making the runs at first.
Because they really only had one opening batsman. They took Bruce Francis, who was a bit out of his depth and was discarded after three tests. They ended up with Ross Edwards and Beadle Watson, Graham Watson, opening. But it was a crazy situation. A bloke called Redpath, who was still to score significant runs for Australia, wasn't selected.
Wow.
Was not selected. Graham McKenzie was considered past his best. David Colley got the chance to go. So it was a bit of a strange group that Australia took away on that tour. And the other interesting thing, while we're talking around it and with the media involvement in the game of cricket before Kerry Packer charged along, I think it's at least anecdotally as the story of Packer saw the numbers when the ABC did live coverage of Australia's fourth innings run chase at the Oval when they got home by 5 wickets on the back of Sheehan and Marsh's batting. And the numbers were just out of this world for the live television audience. It had never been done before, live television of Test cricket from England. It was at the time, let me think, it was just before colour television started in Australia. So that was another big moment in the series, which enabled Australia to draw the series 2-2. So a fantastic series, which led in time, of course, to 74-5. And we can all remember what happened with Tomo and Lilly in that series as Australia regained the Ashes. But it was a wonderful time to be around the game of cricket. There wasn't as much cricket as there is today. You didn't have 10 million IPL games to watch. You had to go down the road to Coogee Oval or somewhere to watch great cricket.
Yeah. So it's interesting you mentioned that. When I was looking through this, the other notable fact out of this game, or stat as such, is the fact that this was Australia's first win in the 70s. So it's in July 72, and yet Australia hadn't won a test match since December 1969. They went 30 months without a win, and yet if you look through the calendar years of 70 and 71, it was only something like 4 or 6 test matches played in those years. So sometimes we look back with rose-coloured glasses and think about how wonderful it was back then. We have more test cricket today than we had for sort of many of these eras and these years, where you might get half a dozen test matches and that'll be it.
We probably got, if you really wanted to examine it acutely, we've got more attractive test cricket, certainly amongst the top nations now, than we did back in those days. It's a more combative, challenging game than it was back in the days when there were some great players like a Dennis Lilly, Geoffrey Boycott here on this ground in 70-71 when England won the series in the 7th test match. That was in its way pretty good to watch, but nothing like most of the cricket we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the ABC's coverage of it. I imagine those tapes will be there in the archives somewhere, Jim, of the 5th test and the run chase at the Oval.
I think you could find them if you went to the BBC, but I'm told there's a slight shortage of tape back in the day, and they had to go over a lot of these archive tapes because they didn't have enough fresh tape around to make new programs, highlights, whatever.
So there's the run chase in the 5th test. It's also Bob Massey's 16 wickets taped over.
So I hear.
Amazing.
There's probably a rugby league grand final there somewhere.
Everybody's got a story like that, don't they, at home, where you think, I remember taping something, and maybe the kids out there nowadays haven't experienced that, but and then someone will tape over it for some other incident or whatever it turns out to be, and you've lost some golden recording. So you were there, Lords, 1972, for this episode with Bob Massey, of course. How has the ground changed, Jim? I mean, you were there as recently as, what, a year ago. How's the ground changed over the years at Lords?
It's full. It wasn't in those days. Right. I was back there in 75 when went on another tour when I was working for the ABC and got away. It was after the World Cup final, and there were four tests, not for the Ashes, played at the same time. And I don't remember the ground being full on any of those days or in the Ashes of 72. So the game has moved on. Maybe that's got a bit to do with the fact that it's not on free-to-air television anymore in England, which is a shame in itself. But the grounds in England, the last five, six, seven Ashes series are full.
Here's the first ball of the Ashes. It's Australia's captain Cummins who runs in and bowls outside the Australian. Take that. Well, that answers a few questions.
And, you know, the going rate's pretty steep for an Aussie dollar. And that has been another significant change. It may have been the case when Bradman was playing before the war that the grounds were always full. But for quite a while after the war, if you looked at around the terraces, the grounds weren't full for these games. Perhaps different dynamics too. Working days during the week, people went to work. Now, I don't know. That doesn't seem to happen for a lot of people. They work from home.
Work from
home. Of course.
Yeah.
Work from home. But yeah, that's the other dynamic. The ground is a better ground for the spectators than it used to be. I think that's also a factor. I think there's a bit more alternative stuff, like most cricket grounds in the world today, where, well, maybe not quite like the Adelaide Oval, where you can spend the whole match socialising with your friends and not even see a ball bowled if you're out the back in the tent.
All the great traditions we talk about nowadays, they were still happening back then, the champagne corks going off and at Lords back in the 70s?
Well, that hasn't changed.
Yep.
You're allowed to bring a bottle into the ground. I don't think there's any other ground in the world where you'd be allowed to do that.
Yep.
So maybe we've got a bit of growing up to do if we can manage it. And the other good thing in England is, as a rule, they, maybe not Lords now, but they allow the fans onto the ground to kiss the turf or touch it with a roped-off square during the day. They do it in South Africa, but I think they just throw their arms up in Australia and say, oh, too many people in the ground. Security risk. Won't do that. But it's a nice touch.
Last one, you mentioned off the top, you were doing this world tour, travelling, playing cricket in all different corners of the globe. Was there a particular country or continent that was good to you as a young dashing batsman at the time, Jim?
Swansea. And Swansea at a place called Gortsainen, which was a rugby club. And I made some runs there. And I remember facing Don Shepherd, who was a very famous Glamorgan bowler, used to bowl back breaks at pace. And I donged him for a couple of sixes down at St. Helens where Sobers hit those sixes. But to be honest, my cricket was pretty mediocre in a group of good players, a couple of first-class cricketers and a lot of first-grade cricketers, but it was a lot of fun. Nothing better than being in an English dressing room with a jug of warm beer after a day's play.
The great Jim Maxwell with his memories of the Ashes across his time. So that is number five on our countdown. We have four to go as we count down Jim's Ashes moments here on ABC Sport.
A young Jim Maxwell in the stands at Lords. How good was that? Jim's next Ashes memory comes from the commentary box as Australia tried to mount an incredible comeback in the 1982 Boxing Day Test.
And there was still a hope against hope that maybe Australia could get a few more runs. I remember, you know, we all say things that we live to regret, want to forget. And at the time, quite often we say them without knowing what we've said. And I can still remember my contribution to the day was the crowd that's been let in free today are getting their money's worth.
That's next time on Jim's Ashes special.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.